This is Croydon Radio, and this is Poets Anonymous. The Troop Ship by Isaac Rosenberg. Grotesque and queerly huddled contortionist to twist the sleepy soul to a sleep. We lie all sorts of ways and cannot sleep. The wet wind is so cold, and the lurching men so careless that, should you drop to a doze, winds fumble, or men's feet are on your face.
Thank you, Peter. That was Peter Evans reading The Troop Ship, written by Isaac Rosenberg, after a channel crossing to Le Havre in early June in 1916, on his way to the Western Front. Further back on this date, the 5th of June in 1898, Frederick Lorca was born. More recently, five members of Poets Anonymous have been included in a celebratory tribute to William Shakespeare, 400 years of. And the book is published by Live Canon, and it includes poems in response to Shakespeare's sonnets. One's from Joe Sanders, one's from Nick Aldridge, one from Ariane Destiny, Anne Smith, and Charlie Aldridge. The poems our poets' poems are facing the appropriate sonnet in the anthology. And it's available from Live Canon, and it costs only $15.49. Can it be bought anywhere else, Peter?
I'm sure it can. I should probably try it on Amazon, but you can get it through the Live Canon website.
Thanks, mate. Yesterday, the world said goodbye to boxing's rhymer, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee, Muhammad Ali. And in the 4th of June in 1783, Joseph and Jacques Montgolfier made their first balloon flight. And in the Croydon Radio balloon, we have today Paul Carney and Orlando Marsden. Paul was long listed in the 2015 National Poetry Competition, and his first poetry collection, The Empty Horizon, is due to be published by Live Canon again later this year, probably sometime in the autumn. Having won their first collection competition, judged by Glyn Maxwell, and Orlando is a storyteller, writing and gobsmackingly excellent poet, as will be heard. And now let's hear from our guest, Orlando.
Thank you. Thank you, Ted. Here are a few poems about travelling, roughly. Sea song. Calm should your passage be. Follow the furrowing wave, riding, not reaping the ripples. Keep to the coastline. Cling to the constant, the known. Reading skies rapidly, glance over glassy grey seas. Eyes on the mainmast obscure the horizon, the distance. Stay in the shallows, the shadow of land in your view. Thus shall you anchor in safety, feigning, not feeling the voyage. So sang the seafarer, eyes filled with islands and ways between islands. Ship cutting waters as green as the cliffside's dark pines. Land and rock kept apart his deep paths where the mountains lay rooted. Round the deep rutted wake of the vessel, white birds screamed and dipped. Only he knew the watery ways past each island. Maps and charts filled his head. His attention was all for the sea. And next is a poem about travel. You can buy a ticket to travel on a train from a machine if you can read instructions and perform the moves in the right order and present the money in the right shape, not copper nor soft worn paper edges. Or you can buy a ticket from the impatient man in his office box, waiting in line until at last your turn, when he takes your money, but he doesn't know the time or platform. I'm just here to sell him. Look at the board, which never shows your destination, only some towns that might be on the way, but knowing no geography, you can't be sure. Then find the platform through the shops for magazines and books and scarves and food and underwear and people dragging their lives behind them in a case or wearing them packed upon their backs like snails to trip or thump you as you scuttle by. The time, the platform, oh, the time and train, the platform and the train, and you're away to some little known place, ticketed safely, hurtling through the fields. I'd like to buy a ticket to keep still. I'd pay in ducats or doubloons or fairy gold, just so that I may stay in quiet and calm here, where I have my books and music, garden, work and play all in one place. And if you dare to travel, we could share a meal and a bottle, and some talk of how, keeping this ticket still, we can share peace, unpack our lives. And yet another travelling poem. Knowing the times of trains, you can afford to finish your tea before you leave for the station. You can avoid the long wait reading posters, old papers on the wet platform. You can sit with your face to the engine, watching the gardens and houses slide by. You can alight at your station, grasping your personal possessions, boldly ignoring the gap, trusting the escalator, fearlessly finding new lines as you move underground, knowing the times, the connections. You can leave your uncertainties, the familiar, safe in your mind. And finally, another sort of travel called outside. Coming in on a spring evening when the sun still shines, the earth smells warm through petrol haze of town, I feel I should be going out, finding a park, a wood, where trees begin to bud and crocuses, tired of their struggle through the grass, gleam limp and damp, and daffodils' faint yellow scent breathes on the evening air. The cat wants to go out, but she's too small. A fox might eat her. She strains longingly at windows, quivers at strange cats, and darts her yearning paws at flights of birds. Sometimes she creeps through gaps in open windows, sits on the sill, surveys the world she cannot visit yet. She makes collections, tiny souvenirs from stolen trips outside, a wing of sycamore in skeleton, a clump of moss, a pigeon feather wrapped in guttered leaves. I find these treasures scattered round the house. I want, they say, I want outside a world. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Orlando. Now, our next guest is Paul Carney.
Hello.
Hello. Is equally gobsmacking, but in a totally different way.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I've not been called that before. Okay, this is a poem. It's about a woman named Roisin who lives in Dawlish. She's in that particular bit of Dawlish that you've all seen on the news where the railway is right in front of the beach and it was destroyed by the storm, but this is long before then. And she's there very much against her will. She's with a family of West Country hippies who kind of use her as a bit of an unpaid skivvy and babysitter. And she's fantasising about the man whom she hopes is going to come and take her away from all this. And it's called Roisin's Dream of Escape. I cannot send you a starling. I must leave it to you to look out of your window and just know by the drift of smog, by foxes gibbering in the alleys, by whatever speaks to you, that it is time. Then you will go down to your Land Rover and set out, guided by the morning star, migrating gulls and motorway signs, to where the railway borders the sea on the dreary shores of the west. By lunchtime you could be here, right here in this house, stooping to enter, standing solid like a horse in the hallway. The others will not welcome you. There will be clattering, clamour and consternation, hands grabbing, tugging at my clothes to bundle me back into the kitchen and lock the doors about me. But you, in a gentle brickwork-shaking murmur, will explain that today everything has changed and send me upstairs to gather my things, which will take no time. I have a Tesco's bag ready. When I come down, it will be into the silence of no more to be said, and you will hoist me up and over the broad ledge of your shoulder. As we go, I'll raise my head just long enough to smile through a tumbled curtain of hair, a smile of absolution for everything upon a Pompeian tableau of others, fixed in the slow-falling dust of the hallway, then out, rump first, into daylight. Your boots will crunch over the gravel, and my fingers at your back will curl in the rough green wool of your sweater. The hell train grinding loud along the beach will salute us with a siren shriek of farewell as the damned lean from their carriage windows to cheer us off. I shall wave an acknowledging foot. The sun will glitter on all the shifting ridges of the sea, but no more of that, not another glance at the empty horizon. Fold me then into that waiting car, and I will slide on warm leatherette. Lean above me, pull the seatbelt over me, and already I shall be breathing the slower breath of sleep. I'll just do one more that follows on directly from that one. This is pretty much continuing the fantasy where she imagines that he's brought her all the way back to London, where she comes from and where she dreams of getting back to. And it's called When We Come Out of the West. Bring me back to the city. Take my arm to steer me among the bus stops, blasted pillar boxes and Jehovah's Witnesses. Find me colonnades to saunter through, fountains to drench me, and buy balloons for this my homecoming. Don't laugh if you catch me photographing statues or tracing a finger along the flaking curls of iron railings. Come with me to buy shoes so I can go without hurt over the cobbles, except when I stumble, which I will. You will grow used to this. Learn to catch me. Loiter with me in the caverns of Euston. Describe the saris and the streamels, teetering headscarves and gauzy rainbow trousers. The citizens will point and make their children stare at us. Don't mind this. Hold my arm tight and keep me walking. Move me into your rooms. I don't take up much space, but I will strew paper everywhere. That's what I do. Carry me to bed sometimes. The long sighs of cars out on the Westway and a bewildered robin singing to the street lamps might soothe me into sleep, no longer troubled by dreams of the sea. I'll bring you instant coffee in the mornings. We'll stand by your window, timing the passage of clouds between the chimneys. In summer, we'll dine with your expensive friends and go drinking with the cheap ones. Light their faces with bottled candles. I might even speak to them. Dirty jokes with all the different voices, or stories of the waiting souls in hollow trees. I can do it all. I'll make you proud of me, but cut my food for me without my asking if the lights go down too early. On days of storms when no one else is out and the sky is darker than the rooftops, I'll be up and gone before you've dressed, searching in streets that have forgotten me for where the printer's shop once stood, or sheltering under the bandstand in the park, mumbling the song of the monkey in the cellar. But promise you'll be there when the rain won't come. And on your busiest days, release me in the museum and let me roam in labyrinths of glass, where I will grow smaller and younger through the drowsy afternoon. Collect me at sunset after closing. I will be the last one sitting high up on the stone steps, pretending to look out for you.
That was lovely, Paul.
Thank you.
I'd like you to do another one, if you could, please. Have you got one handy?
Oh,
if you zip through your super machine. Yes,
we've got my 5 minutes. I'm fumbling here. I've got them all on a.
You're doing fine.
An e-reader, because I find it so much easier than.
Later we'll find out how Paul felt when he was longlisted in a poetry competition, which is quite interesting, because I think he's got quite a little story about that.
Bear with me.
What's happening? Has anyone out there been longlisted? Do you know if you've been longlisted?
Where are we? There we are. I'll just quickly do this one then. If you're sure there's time.
There is.
So I'm touching my nose to the microphone. Am I all right for the distance?
You're perfect.
Here we go. Okay. This is called Monster Child. It's about the same character. At this point, she's realised that no one is coming to rescue her. So she's finally found her way to the station and she's off, but she's leaving a note for one of the children that she used to look after. Today will be hard. You will lurk in dusty half light, hands and feet braced high in the kitchen door frame until your limbs are aching, the gappy grin begins drooping at the corners, and no one comes downstairs to be terrified. I had meant to go by degrees, huddling into smaller corners, taking on the colour of the walls, whispering in time with the breaking waves until no one could quite say whether I was here or not. But fading takes so long. Autumn has begun already, and my window has never had curtains. I've been measuring the falling length of days, and soon the roads will freeze. I will try to close the door softly behind me. Today you will have to stomp loudly on the stairs, little monster, and yell for your breakfast, louder than your mother's nightmares. So loud that you will scare away the pigeons. Soon you will all go stomping through these rooms, roaring my name in chorus. Remember that. I have left you the book of how to draw skeletons and breasts, and all the paints and pastels I don't need now. Television will light your face, your mother will sing, your father will come sometimes out of the trees, and now and then the cat will walk his slow requiem down the span of the piano keys in memory of the dog now beatified. And you, my monster, you will learn to go loping over the Exeter Road with no one beside you clutching at your hand. Your teetering cities of Lego and card will rise and sprawl in my room where maybe you will name a street after me.
Thank you very much indeed. After that little kerfuffle, I think it's appropriate that I do this called Bizarre, and it's for Karl Berjikov. Words and letters fall from the open page, flowing as sand falls into a cone on the floor, spreading full flow until they can reach no further. Gathering them in handfuls, I place them on a tray, and as jigsaw pieces are separated, placed into shapes and sizes, words and letters. Each word examined for ambiguity and intended meaning, then impressed into a shape on the page. The letters are like crosswords without clues, a code word. They are pushed and turned, sifted and sorted into words, removed and placed aside until patterns are formed and answers resolved. And there are none left over. They make their own form as though they are corners, straight edges or solutions to unasked questions. Although it cannot be true, what you hear or read or hear now here is what the words said.
Thank you, Ted. Our first piece of music today is poetry by Chip and Drifty from their album O Profundity. This track is almost a complete education on poetry by itself.
Listen, this is poetry. Rhyme this word with that one. Ready, here it comes. Onomatopoeia, come on, I wanna see ya. Come over here and give me some. I am Big Pentameter. I get what you said. I've written something so romantic, so heartfelt and sweet, you fall down and weep. I want to see you naked in my bed. Is that what girls like? Sweet somethings, this is how you like me. I can be soft and sensitive if that would help things, or maybe not, I guess. Haiku, I like you, your hair seems like a river. Now let's get it on. Sometime you and I make such a perfect couplet. Epigram or sonnet, if it's poetry, I'm on it. Now let's explore your feminine rhyme. Is that what girls like? Sweet something, this is how you like me best. I can be soft and sensitive. That would help things, or maybe not, I guess. I can be soft and sensitive if that would help things, or maybe not. I guess
it's favourite poem time, and mine comes from Bloodhound by Lisa Kelly, and it is called Home Move. It's what I describe as an in-and-out poem. You will discover in a second. She always said the best security is your neighbours. Protested against the railings and the council wanted to erect. When she was ill, she thumped on the wall with her stick. Then next door knew something was wrong. Some of the older residents complained about the noise, but she thought the young people added energy. Stairs were a struggle. When the lifts failed, it took half a lifetime to reach her floor. Now she was grounded in more appropriate accommodation. She told them she was managing, but they disagreed. It's people that make the difference, not buildings. The turnaround made her dizzy. Sometimes she felt unsafe. Sometimes she felt unsafe. The turnaround made her dizzy. But it's people that make the difference, not buildings. She told them she was managing, but they disagreed. Now she was grounded in more appropriate accommodation. It took half a lifetime to reach the door. Stairs were impossible when the lifts failed. The young people had no energy. Some of them complained about her noise. Next door knew something was wrong. When she was ill, she thumped on the wall with her stick, protested against the bed rails the council wanted to erect. She always said the best security is in your neighbours.
That was a mirror poem, wasn't it, Ted?
That's the one, an in-and-out mirror poem.
Right, I've got a poem by Billy Collins. Introduction to Poetry. I ask them to take a poem and hold it up to the light like a colour slide, or press an ear against its hive. I say, drop a mouse into a poem and watch him probe his way out, or walk inside the poem's room and feel the walls for a light switch. I want them to water ski across the surface of a poem, waving at the author's name on the shore. But all they want to do is tie the poem to a chair with rope and torture a confession out of it. They begin beating it with a hose to find out what it really means.
My poem is by Jane Griffiths, a poem against the kind of occasional verse. A poem against the kind of occasional verse which starts with a long quavering line like the run-up to a marginal doodle on a set of lecture notes, the sort which starts as a circle, becomes an eye, grows a quiff and some flowers which sprout from an enormous ear that's attached to a retrospective teapot spout and culminates in a set of legs like those which belong to an occasional table of the unassuming kind, which can almost be pushed, almost, to one side. Not just because the element of surprise is lost, or because the ends of lines loiter without intent like drunks on the pavement at closing time, but mainly because of the pretense that the writer is simply part of the scenery, part of a bar stool or a swift triangle of red skirt round the ellipse of the Sheldonian, who has stumbled upon herself, as upon the occasional table or chair leg, and observed herself and written her down, unassuming and pie as the artless voice on the telephone, whispering, "It's only me," when really it is I all the time.
Paul.
Okay, mine is it's by the late Canadian poet and astronomer Rebecca Elson. It's from her posthumous collection, A Responsibility to Awe, published by Carcanet Press, and this one is called Antidotes to Fear of Death. Sometimes, as an antidote to fear of death, I eat the stars. Those nights, lying on my back, I suck them from the quenching dark till they are all inside me. Pepper hot and sharp. Sometimes, instead, I stir myself into a universe still young, still warm as blood. no outer space, just space. The light of all the not-yet stars drifting like a bright mist, and all of us and everything already there, but unconstrained by form. And sometimes it's enough to lie down here on earth beside our long ancestral bones, to walk across the cobble fields of our discarded skulls, each like a treasure, like a chrysalis, thinking whatever left these husks flew off on bright wings.
Thank you, Paul. Our next bit of music continues our poetic education. This is Assonance is Bliss by Mixi.
Okay, kids, my name's Mixi. I'm gonna do some work with you on rhyme. I use a lot of rhyme in my work now. Who can tell me what rhymes with metal? You got some? Good. Let's see what we can do. I use clippers made of metal to cut petals from my nettles. Then I boil them in the kettle, mix it with some dettol, let the mixture settle, then pour it out and leave a trail like Hansel and Gretel. But then you run out. What if I said metal rhymes with special? That can be called a half rhyme, feminine rhyme, or assonance. Cool? Let's see what we can do. I go to see my auntie Ethel. I know she's gonna send me to the shop to buy some lentil, but my car's out of petrol, so I grab my bike and pedal. And when I get back, she'll treat me so special, like I deserve a medal. But if I get it wrong, she'll go mental and take time to bombard me with pebbles. But again, you, after a while, run out. So what if you break down syllables and match separate words, like I met all her friends, one gave me a netball, which I let fall as it brought back memories of how I couldn't get tall. She told me to bounce it as I left for the pet store to make the vet call. And again, sure enough, we will run out. But if we put everything down together, then let's see how far we can get. Okay. When I got to this animal mess hall, I leaned against what turned out to be a wet wall. I was vexed pure, now I need some new garments so I can dress more appropriate for Auntie's next chore. I got Aggie, incredible Hulk style, my vest tore. Grew Freddy Krueger style, flex claws in set fours, beat my chest roared. I need a Venom or a Nextdoor, that's what my inner GPS cords got set for. Went 0 to 60 in a sex saw down the road in my fresh Porsche. Okay, it was a wrecked Ford. Got Larry as I necked poor. Okay, I mean apple juice through a bent straw, weaving in and out of traffic, tunes banging like a bed or sex worn headboard, while my exhaust rattled like a travel chessboard or Scrabble. 12 down, experimental hench score. Okay, I know, yes, poor, still kept up the speed through the residential area, sped more than I ever meant to. Still I kept warm, coffee would be a clever level. I wanna rest, sprawl out on the deck, yawn, but I can't yet crawl back into bed. Oh, I should have left a small Red Bull on my chest to draw so I could wake up fresh this morning. Instead my head's falling heavy jaw. Got my pedal to the metal core, blimey, do I feel grimy. Did I mention my car's a rental? Still drive smooth as menthol and flash my dental. Assonance is bliss, so I test all schemes till they get full and stretch. Talking ways I bet you all will hate or take stressful. I respect all set forms to connect more words. I'm the blessor, so why not let me explore? Assonance is bliss. Pick up Climax and Juxta on beats and production. Locality, dead poetry. We're always moving forward, so big up if you support it.
That was Mixi doing Assonance is a Bliss. And continuing this educational information, we're going to talk about workshops. Workshops, boys and girls. Like them? Loathe them? Are they helpful? Have you done many?
Yeah, I've done a lot of workshops. They're brilliant. In my time.
They're the best.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's the thing that keeps a lot of people working, really, because you think, oh, my God, I haven't written anything for the next workshop. So you get set to it, really, don't you? And,
Part of the discipline of writing?
Definitely, yeah, I would say so. Because, as Orlando says, it keeps you working. You feel... You're not actually obliged to come up with something new for every week, but you feel like you ought. And, you know, that helps if the motivation is lacking at all. So it's good in that way. And, you know, the feedback that you get is absolutely
vital. Yes. No, feedback is very important. Because if you're writing, it's a very solitary thing. I mean, if you're an amateur musician or singer or a theatrical person, you go and do it with other people, don't you?
Yes.
Whereas writing now, you do it in your little room all by yourself and nobody knows you're doing it unless you grab them by the elbow and say, hey, listen to this. And my God, who does that? No, you wouldn't dare, would you? So, in fact, you need a workshop where everybody is giving their innermost souls in this supposedly comfortable place. And it is usually comfortable. People are enormously kind at these workshops, don't you find, Paul?
Very much really? So, yes, yeah. Because, you know, we're all quite experienced at it. We're a little sort of hand-picked band, aren't we?
Yeah.
And, you know, we know to be rigorous but respectful.
Yes.
Definitely,
yes,
always.
Yes.
And it's really helpful. You know, my poems regularly get, you know, really mauled about in a good way. And you come home with loads of little notes and annotations and things about how to make them better. And
Do you take any
notice of the notes?
Let
me clarify.
Yeah.
At the workshops, you read out your poem, and does everyone contribute to the lit crit?
Yes, yes, yes. Okay. Everybody has their say.
Yeah. You don't get to sit quietly, do you?
No.
Barbara will say,
to,
you know,
yes.
Any more comments?
Yes. Okay. We should say, perhaps, we both go to a class with Barbara Marsh.
Okay.
And there are about 5, 6, 7 of us, depending.
That's nice. Not too many.
No, because you've got to have time to go through your bit. And then everybody has their say on your bit.
Whereabouts?
It's actually at the Festival Hall at the moment.
Okay.
But,
rather nice.
Well, when they're not throwing us out because they need
that's
space.
They've got something unimportant on.
Yeah, something terribly unimportant.
Yeah. Way back, we used to be at the Barbican Centre. The Festival Hall is nicer. Definitely nicer.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's fun. The work is good.
A prestigious environment like that must go for... nice to go along to instead of a dingy classroom somewhere. You mentioned lots of... Are all the workshops all the same? Tell me about workshops. Yes.
Well, the one we go to is kind of special because it's small.
Yeah.
And and it's very professional because Barbara Marsh is a professional poet. Yeah. And among other things. And so that is immensely helpful. You feel you're getting a lot of help there. But there are other... I think we've both been to Morley College, which is also helpful in its way, but you get more of a class there, you know, more people and of vastly differing levels and abilities and things. And that in itself is useful and helpful because you see what other people do.
Do your tutors bring form into their... Do you have to go and write a sonnet or do you have to go and write half a dozen haikus or... A rondo or a...
Nothing like that. I found in the Morley classes, mine was also taught by Barbara Marsh, and the workshop is kind of an extension of that in a way. It's similar, but like advanced level. We were never told what to write. You could write a prose piece or a poem, as the case may be, and certainly in the workshop. I'm the only person in our workshop at the moment regularly bringing poems, aren't I?
That's true.
Orlando's working on a wonderful novel for young adults.
Yes, I hope it's wonderful.
It is. It's great fun to do. Every week.
And Paul, you've now got your first collection out.
It's not out yet. It's coming out sometime around the autumn, I think, around September, October.
Lovely. And will that include your long-listed poem?
It will, yes.
Yeah. Tell us about the long-listed poem.
Oh. I was long-listed in the National Poetry Competition 2 years in succession with the same poem, which was...
Are you really allowed to do that?
You are, yes, because if you only make the long list, they publish your name but not the name of the poem and not indeed the poem itself, so it's free... to be entered elsewhere and indeed to them again. And I didn't just enter the same poem. I sent them a batch of stuff each time. And I thought most of what I sent them was better than the one that keeps getting picked out and longlisted. That one rhymed. I never write anything that rhymes. I wrote that one just to make a point to one of my tutors at Goldsmiths. You know, I can write rhyme if I want to. I don't because I choose not to. But I just send it out with the others at competition time and... It got longlisted twice. It was just odd, you know.
You are going to enter it within a batch next year, aren't you?
I can't now because it's coming out in the collection, so it's it will no longer be eligible for rules of rules.
I'd be lovely to say third time lucky.
Not with that one.
Coming on to the collection, An Empty Horizon sounds a bit sad to me.
I suppose it is in a way. It's a sequence of poems. I was working on it during my MA at Goldsmiths, and at one point I was writing poetry and prose, and I didn't know if it was going to be a sort of little novel or, you know, combined poetry and prose. It ended up kind of turning into all poetry in the end, but it's a sequential thing. It's about the story of a woman who is trapped in Dawlish in South Devon, right on the very edge of South Devon. As I said, that bit where the railway and the beach are right in front of a row of houses. And she's there because this woman is, she's supposed to be a writer and a children's illustrator. And she's working on a children's book about a child living in the time of St. Patrick in medieval Ireland. But while she's working on this book, she has no money. So she's living with a family who she sort of knows. They're friends of hers, but they're becoming increasingly unfriendly. They use her as a kind of unpaid babysitter and skivvy. And it's got to the point where really she's had enough, but they know that she can't get out because she's visually impaired. She's losing her sight. That's the other thing. And she literally can't find her way to the station. And the only other contact that she has... Sorry, I'm biffing the microphone.
No, you're fine. You're fine.
The only other contact she has is with her publisher, her editor at the publishers, whom she speaks to on the phone, but she's never met him. And because he's got a lovely deep northern accent, she's kind of projected onto him that he must be some kind of huge, rugged Ted Hughes figure who will someday come striding over the moors and, you know, pick her up and throw her over his shoulder and carry her away from this bad situation that she's in. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, no spoilers, but he's possibly not the man she thinks he is, you know. But that's pretty much the theme of the whole collection, you know.
Just a thing. Sorry. Orlando, you're going through writing a novel.
Yeah.
And
yes.
brilliant.
There's an interesting connection here in as much that basically Paul's writing a novel, but he's writing the pertinent facts.
But he's doing it in poems.
In poems.
Yes. I tried. Yes.
Yeah.
He's telling a story in poems. Well, I'm too idle to do that, you see. It's much easier to write prose.
Is it?
So, yes, I think so.
I like that in a book, in a book of poetry, that there's a sequence, there's a link between
they carry
each
on,
poem
yes,
and they
yes.
carry on.
No,
and in its own way, it tells a story.
Yeah, yeah. But story is everything.
I found very few of them. Sorry.
No, go on.
I was going to say, when I was working on that, you know, during my MA, I found very few examples to use as a model. I think probably the best one I found was it's a sequence by Amanda Dalton called Room of Leaves. It's in her collection How to Disappear. Mm. And it's this bizarre thing about a woman who's jilted at the altar and she goes mad and builds herself a big nest, like a huge bird's nest, in her mother's garden and just lives in it for the rest of her life.
And okay.
Gosh.
Very strange and sad.
I'd like to read
that. And it's a kind of a sequential thing. You know, it tells a story in different voices. You've got mainly her voice, also the voice of the man who jilted her and feels a bit guilty about her, and the voice of the policeman who discovers her body in the garden at the end of the...
Oh, lovely.
that's not a spoiler, because that's the beginning of the sequence.
Miss Havisham and the Archers mixed.
Yeah. And talking of gardens and garden beds, so I'm going to put this little bit to bed, and we're going to have some music from Peter. Thank you both very, very much indeed.
Pleasure.
Today is the birthday of Laurie Anderson, besides being that of Lorca.
You were born, and so you're free. So happy birthday.
So this is Laurie Anderson's track, Beautiful Pea Green Boat.
I'm lying in the shade of my family tree. I'm a branch that broke off. What will become of me? Dear Mom, I'm lying here in this queen-sized bed. I'm thinking back to all the stories you read to me about those little animals who went to sea in their beautiful pea-green boats. But I can't remember now what happened then. Dear Mom, how does it end? The owl and the pussycat went to sea in a beautiful pea-green boat. They took some honey and lots of money wrapped in a 5-pound note. The owl looked up to the stars above and sang to a small guitar. Oh, lovely pussy, pussy, my love, what a wonderful pussy you are. You are, you are. Let us be married. Too long we've tarried, but what shall we do for a ring?
A ring,
a ring,
a ring.
What shall we do for a ring?
Hey!
Palm tree grows. And there in a wood a piggy wig stood, a ring at the end of his nose,
his nose,
his nose, a ring at the end of his nose. And hand in hand at the edge of the sand, they danced by the light of the, by the light of the, by the light of the moon. And hand in hand, at the edge of the sand, they danced by the light of the, by the light of the, by the light of the moon. The moon, the moon.
Was Laurie Anderson with her interpretation of Beautiful Pea Green Boat. Our next meetings are Thursday the 9th of June in Matthew's Yard off Surrey Street, Croydon, from 7:30 p.m. Saturday the 11th of June in the Primary Room at the United Reformed Church, Addiscombe Grove, East Croydon, from 2:30 p.m. Then the first Friday of the month, the 1st of July, at the Annerley Arms, 2 Ridsdale Road, SE28AB. And it's right outside Annerley Station on the London-bound side. And that's from 8 p.m. Then Saturday, the 2nd of July, Poets Anonymous are hosting an afternoon of poetry on the bandstand in Wandle Park between 2 p.m. and 5:30 p.m., which is only 3 tram stops from East Croydon Station. So come along for a summer's afternoon in the park. Bring your poems to read. And it should be fun. And we are back here on Croydon Radio the next day on the 3rd of July.
Peter, do we have a guest poet at Wandle?
We have, yes we do.
Patrick?
And yes, Patrick Kinnaid, who was on here a couple of months ago.
Yeah, a member, leader of Dodo Modern Poets, who do poetry in wonderfully anyway. Right, to continue with our two guests, who are going to take you up on their poetry balloon, kicking off with Paul. Paul, please.
Okay, I like the balloon idea. I'm kind of stuck on that. Okay, this is another piece in the voice of the same character. She's explaining to her editor and partial fantasy figure about why, you know, why the whole illustration thing is becoming more difficult for her because she's losing her sight. And it's called The Art of Self-Portraiture. Am I near the... There it is. Sorry, I lost sight of it. Here we go. The Art of Self-Portraiture. If you send me a photograph, whether or not your jawline is how I imagined, I'll fix you to my wall, lie down beneath you, tell you secrets, and undress before your face at bedtime with all the lamps still on. And I would answer with a snapshot of my own, but I've been careless. The children got in here as I was sleeping, and now my father's camera lies in irreconcilable pieces. So I will draw my likeness for you. Though it's your move, I shall make a start while there is light descending in a blank sky over the water and slamming into this room. There are no warm flesh tones here. I'm only stark white and shadows. I've made a place to lean the mirror, and here are the broken ruler, the tape measure, and the calipers. No, there is not much free hand here anymore. I'm all geometry and joined the dots now. You see, the losing of art is a slow thing, like the death of trees. Perhaps you've noticed signs already in my later pages, an ill-proportioned salmon, or a wandering chicken on some cobbled street whose head is just too big, the lopsided grins of the beetle chasers in the lane, and how the bell tower leaned far out of kilter until all buildings turned to charcoal smudges lost in the sea fog. To shape a single face these days, I must make such a scaffold of lines. Take my eyes, so far apart I have to plot their latitude against the perpendicular. Of course I press too hard. No watercolour wash will hide these marks, so you will always see my face like this, quartered by a cross. I wanted to smile at you and show you every glistening, naked tooth, but this will be a long labour, so you can have my nothing face, my somewhere far from here face. To make amends, I'll tug the neckline of my T-shirt down to bare one shadowed clavicle and the hollow of my throat. And then there is my hair. That will be fun. I do good hair even now. The wilder, the more frazzled, the more backward through hedges, the better I scrawl it. I will go crazy with this hair and make so much of it, because these days will end untidily and soon, with torn and scrunched up paper lying everywhere, and no final masterpiece amid the rubbish. These pencils, pens and brushes won't be laid aside, packed in a drawer or handed down on some remembered day, only mislaid, scattered, rattling down the stairs, rolling into cracks and dark corners. Is there time for one more?
Yes.
Okay. Where are we? Where's it gone?
Just to fill you in here, Live Canon, it's worth noting, are the publishers, both Paul's book, Empty Horizon, also Shakespeare's 154 sonnets. And if we're lucky, we'll be able to have some of the writers from the sonnet book in the future. Paul.
Thank you. Okay, this is from the end of the sequence, actually. At this point, the character has somehow got away from Dawlish and, you know, it's a happy ending of sorts because she's back in her childhood bedroom in her parents' house, and it's called A Room in the City. My hands know every nubble of the wallpaper. The wind still shuffles about behind the fireplace. On better days, I go downstairs for dinner. Tomorrow we shall have paper hats. It's Christmas on television. We carried up the angled lamp to stand it by my bed, bending above the pillow. The rooftops opposite, the aerials, the stunted trees like broccoli, forming my skyline, are the same but farther off. The birds that come and go are more like shadow puppets now, and never call my name across the street. I may look out at 3:30, my head upon the windowsill, to watch a tangerine and silver sunset, or I may not. So many of the books I learned to read in my cocoon of eiderdown and blankets are here, lined up and leaning on the shelves. Today I took one down and opened it, and every page was white. I think of all the letters I have known, dancing their spider conga down in the narrow space behind the cupboards. The phone rings in two rooms, and I am not afraid. I know it won't be anyone for me. I close this book, I lie here until tea time, stare up at the light bulb, watch the plankton drifting in the fishbowl of my eye, and half my head is in and out of dreams. A man stands on the iron bridge and shouts and points to stars that are not there. How small he looks from here. The clowns are crawling on the roof and laughing in the chimney. Pigeons flap in empty rooms. The starfish hands of children wave through clouds reflected in the windows of a long white car. On a beach, a woman rolls in the surf. An arm flops from a floral-patterned sling, and snow is falling on the tracks and on the sea, covering all the broken wooden boats in silence. And someone on the wall calls out to ask me what I know, but I am gone already. The central heating clanks all through the house. The tumble dryer is growling down in the kitchen, and in the next room someone moves about and sings along off-key with the Seeker's greatest hits. I am a child sitting up in bed, pressing my ear to the wall.
Thank you very much indeed. Orlando, please.
Yeah, right. I've got a few poems about family, really. This is a childhood recollection. I remember days when Sunday dinner smells surged from the windows open to the sun, when pigeons clattered busily in trees and blackbirds shouted loud arpeggios mimicking family favourites on the radio. The savour of roast meat curled round the smell of dampened earth, the lilac, next door's new-cut grass. Dinner was 1 o'clock. The gardening stopped. The men came home relaxed with beer to plates piled high with roast meat and potatoes, boiled veg, and pudding with carnation cream. Dinner was over. Sleep. And children scuffed outside to play again, to make mock stew with bitter chamomile, pinch pungent spears of mint or rosemary, grub in the earth with sticks for worms or stones. The garden settled down, breathed on us children all its private smells. Faint stink of rubber from the garden hose, sweat smell of trampled grass, dank wetness from the dregs of watering can, tar on the sun-warm fence, and even a stealthy, unemphatic drift of thick vanilla hawthorn and a rose. This is called George, who was my dad. He was always there with the umbrella, said our mum. I often wondered why she'd married him. She read The Guardian and did the crossword. Dad read The Sun, just for the racing, he explained. He knew a man's job was to provide clean shoes and put the rubbish out. He never pushed a pram. When we were small, he played gorillas, chasing and tickling deep into our ribs, my nightmare still, and older took us swimming. Is it all right? He'd ask, embarrassed at our growth, our girliness. You should have both been boys, our Nana said. He always thanked our mother for the food, finished our leavings, mustn't waste, and did the washing up and sang The Lord's My Shepherd, Shenandoah, and Sospan Vach in made-up Welsh. Sometimes he'd play the mouth organ of spoons or tap out tunes on glasses, saucepans, plates. You've got no rhythm, girl, he'd say, when I joined in. He had a pipe with a hand carved round the bowl, a velvet silver-tasselled internationals cap from schoolboy days. He smelled of rough tobacco and old sweat. He never washes, said our Nan, who seldom did. Dying, he drank, got sentimental, wept. Look after your mother, girl, he said. He always knew he'd never come in first. Just hoped I'd hold the umbrella and keep off the rain. And this poem is called A Death, and it's to my daughter. I don't remember when my father died. We were in Edinburgh, I know, and in a sad hotel. High ceilings, greying wallpaper, there for a fencing match, though you were ill, fevered and mumbling. And then the call. He's gone not long ago. My brother-in-law's calm voice. The phone smelled sour of other people's breath, the chair dug in my thigh, the window cold with rain. He's dead, I told you, seeing the news slide into your delirium. You did not cry. I wondered how to get the plane on time, carry the luggage and the fencing kit, whether I'd dosed you up enough to walk. Later, I cried, not much, but time to time, smelling sweet pipe tobacco, sweat, or glimpsing an old man in a trilby hat. The time, the day, the year are gone. But it was winter, Edinburgh, cold, and you were ill.
Well, Anna, thank you very much. And Paul, thank you both very much for coming and sharing your poems with us and everyone else who's listening. And thank you for listening.
The final track of today is Laurie Anderson with Let X Equal X, live at the Town Hall, New York City. And as Ted said, thank you all for listening and thank our guests for having been here.
I met this guy, and he looked like he might have been a hat check clerk at an ice rink, which in fact he turned out to be. And I said, oh boy, right again. Let X equal X. You know, it could be you. It's a sky blue sky. Satellites are out tonight. Let X equal X. You know, I could write a book, and this book would be thick enough to stun an ox. 'Cause I can see the future, and it's a place about 70 miles east of here, where it's lighter. Linger on over here. Got the time. Let postcard, and it wrote, it said, dear amigo, dear partner, listen now, I just want to say thanks, so, thanks, thanks for all the presents, thanks for introducing me to the chief. Thanks for putting on the feedback. Thanks for going all out. Thanks for showing me your Swiss Army knife. Oh, and thanks for letting me autograph your cast. Love and kisses, X, 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 X. 0000. Oh, yeah. In a burning building, and I gotta go, 'cause I feel like
fire in the burning building, and I gotta go. She said, it looks, don't you think it looks a lot like rain? He said, isn't it?